Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm speaking with Professor Timothy Mousseau, Associate Vice President for Research and Graduate Education and Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. Since 1999, Professor Mousseau and his collaborators have explored the ecological and evolutionary consequences of the radioactive contaminants affecting birds, insects and people inhabiting the Chernobyl region of the Ukraine. Professor Tim Mousseau is currently co-editor of a new annual review series, The Year in Evolutionary Biology, published by the New York Academy of Sciences, and he joins us now. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Tim.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so are you fundamentally a geneticist?
I had most of my training is in ecological genetics and life history theory and organismal biology is another general area, animal behavior, sort of general ecology, in fact.
Right. So tell us, how did you get initially involved in the Chernobyl research? What was the initial impetus?
You know, like so many things in life, it happened purely by accident.
Yeah.
One of my mentors, the dean of the School of the Environment here at the University of South Carolina, invited me on a short fact-finding trip in 1999, and just to look around and see what the possibilities were. After a few interactions with some of the local scientists, we discovered that there were a lot of opportunities for doing the sort of research that I like doing, which is genetics in a field environment and in nature.
Yeah. You're a bit of a Darwin, are you?
Well, he certainly is one of the people I look up to.
Right.
Sure.
So you went to the Chernobyl area first in 1999. Were you scared?
You know, the first time we went to visit, we were very careful and very cautious. I remember we were being given a tour around the zone, and we actually encountered an older couple who had moved back into the zone, so-called resettlers. And at the time they didn't get a lot of visitors, and so they invited us into their home and showed us where they were living. And then, of course, they pulled out a plate of roasted, fresh roasted pumpkin seeds,
right,
for us to consume. and of course, not wishing to be rude, we were forced to at least make it appear like we were eating some of these seeds. But of course, most of us attempted to spit them out and hide the remains. But yes, we were very cautious and quite concerned about exposure.
How large is the zone, Tim, around the Chernobyl destroyed reactor?
Well, the zone where they currently have a fence is approximately, it varies in diameter, but it's about 35 to 50 kilometers around it, depending on where you are.
That's the perimeter. That's the circumference.
That's the perimeter.
Well, what's the radius from the reactor itself to the perimeter?
About, depending on which direction you go, between 30 and 50 kilometers is the radius. Yeah, so it's a very large area, about 2,000 square miles to make units.
And how radioactive is it, Tim?
It's highly variable, and this is one of the great mysteries of the zone. Because of the way that the wind was blowing and the way it was raining, the fallout actually came down in patches. So some areas within this zone is highly, highly contaminated, 10,000 times sort of the natural background levels in the areas. And then there'll be a patch of, you know, an acre or two that is relatively clean. And so this actually is a very useful tool for studies of the effects of contamination.
Yeah.
Because you can actually compare areas that are really clean to areas that are highly contaminated. They're in the same general vicinity. And you can do this over and over again in different parts of the zone.
And tell us, what are the contaminants, the radioactive isotopes? Have they been tested for? Do you have a list of them that you find in the contamination zone?
Absolutely. They're the usual suspects from nuclear fission, and the most common radioisotope that spread throughout Europe, in fact, is cesium-137. It has a half-life of about, I think it's 29 years or so. The second most abundant radioactive isotope is strontium-90. Strontium-90 is a calcium analog. So wherever, if there are organisms that need calcium, they will take up strontium instead of calcium if calcium is not available. Cesium is a potassium analog, and then the next common, most abundant radioisotope is a very dangerous one, and that's uranium-239, or plutonium-239, sorry.
Yeah.
And it's apparently not as abundant further away from the zone because it's a heavier metal. It's thought to have fallen out closer to the actual reactor. But we still find traces of it many kilometers from the actual reactor site.
Do you think it is spread plutonium? I know cesium spread throughout Europe, but do you think plutonium is too? What are the measurements, Tim?
So you know, there haven't been a lot of measurements of the plutonium distribution because it's actually quite expensive to measure.
Yeah.
You can't measure it in the same ways that you can cesium and strontium. Cesium and strontium you can actually measure with a simple Geiger counter and detect it because they are gamma emitters, among other things. But the plutonium requires a chemical analysis as well. And this makes very, very costly to do extensive sampling. So they, you know, to be honest, I think there's relatively little known about it.
Apart from strontium, cesium, and plutonium, what about the other isotopes? I mean, there were 200 isotopes or more that escaped from the reactor, various radioactive elements, some of which lasted only seconds, but many of which last many years. So have others been tested for yet?
You know, I think the main concern initially, of course, was with iodine-131,
yeah,
which was released in quite large quantities and resulted in many cases of thyroid cancers. But the main concern at the moment, I believe, is the accumulation of americium, which again, I'm not a nuclear physicist, so I'm not well versed in the life history of these elements, but apparently americium levels are expected to increase in the coming years in many of these areas, and apparently americium is a fairly toxic element.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, it's americium-241, and it has a half life, but it's a decay product of plutonium-241, I think. And it has a half-life which is much shorter than plutonium, and it's much more radioactive. I think it's also, apart from being an alpha emitter, I think it's also gamma. So, and people should know that americium is the material that powers all the smoke detectors in all their houses, all their apartments, all their office buildings. And it's okay if it stays up in the smoke detector, but if the place burns down, you can inhale it. Or if it's sent to the rubbish dump, and most smoke detectors are made of plastic, it leaks out into the water supply. So
mm-hmm.
pretty nasty stuff. So anyway, let's get on to the biological findings. Tim, when did you first start studying the biological consequences in the the isolation zone, and what first did you find?
Right. So in 2000, I actually went to visit on a sabbatical a colleague of mine in Paris, France, Dr. Uh-huh. Anders Moller, who had actually been to Chernobyl a couple of times before my visit and done some of the earliest work on the effects in natural populations. And he and I got together and decided we're looking for projects to do together and decided that looking at the genetics and life history consequences to birds living in this zone might be something we could work on together. And so in March and April, I guess late April and May of 2000, we went back to the Ukraine and visited, started by finding as many populations of barn swallows as we could find. Barn swallows are an excellent model organism. They're relatively easy to find. When you find one, you usually find a whole colony of them, so you can catch many individuals in the same population. And because they're often associated with farms and barns, you can usually find them relatively easy and easily. And so we started by collecting barn swallows from 8 or 9 different sites in and out of the Chernobyl zone. And the first paper that we published in 2001, we found that some of these sites had an unusually high frequency of abnormalities. The first abnormality that we documented were these partially albinistic birds with patches of white feathers. Mm-hmm. And again, this had never been, this had been reported, this kind of character had been reported in some populations living close to large cities in polluted areas, but in nowhere else had they been seen. And so we continued this work. We went back for a couple more years looking at these birds during their reproductive season. And in 2003, we published a second paper that showed that the birds, these barn swallows living in the more contaminated areas, had highly variable body shape and size. And this, the pattern that we observed was consistent with there being increased levels of mutations in these birds. And it was kind of surprising to us that the characters that were most sensitive to these contaminants were also characters that tended to indicate the relative fitness of these individuals.
It was
particularly interesting from an evolutionary standpoint in that the characters that were most likely to be used by females in choosing a mate, for instance, the length and symmetry of tail feathers, for instance, or the color of their throat patches. These kinds of characters were the ones that were most likely to show signs of these elevated mutation rates.
What did they show? The throat patches and the tail feathers.
Oh, so they tended to be duller. The birds tended to be duller. The tail feathers tended to be shorter or longer and more asymmetrical than in other populations that we've seen. And again, this tends to reflect what we call developmental instability, the fact that the individual is not able to adjust for either mutational load or other environmental factors and quite to generate the perfect individual, as it were.
Well, then that goes back to what I learned in first year medicine in 1956, that most mutations that occur are deleterious. They cause disease or abnormalities in the ability to propagate species. And there are very few new advantageous mutations that tend to help the propagation of a species. Is that what you're seeing, Tim?
You know, I think that it's one of the central tenets of evolutionary biology is that most mutations either have no effect or deleterious effects.
Yeah.
It's extremely rare that a mutation pops up that has some advantage to the individual that carries it. There's been many eons for mutations to to have been beneficial ones to have been selected, and most organisms do pretty well at what they do, and so any change in the genetic composition tends to push them away from that optimal phenotype. So, they, you know, yeah, mutations usually are slightly deleterious. The ones that are large, that have a large deleterious effect, of course, tend to remove that individual that tends to kill them.
Yeah, they die because of genetic disease.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we've now got over 2,600 genetic diseases described in pediatrics, like cystic fibrosis, diabetes, phenylketonuria, you name it, all of which obviously are deleterious mutations, which have been carried in individuals for many, many generations. They're passed down generation to generation. And so you're seeing new deleterious mutations. Tell me, first of all, you must describe what a mutation is, what a phenotype is to the audience.
Yes. Well, you know, the mutations come in many different forms, but most of the ones that we can document usually involve either a change in a base pair, the DNA that actually codes for the proteins that make us. And so if that base pair, it's a little chemical in the DNA chain in the chromosome, if that changes and it results in a different kind of protein, then that will change either the behavior or the shape or the development, the color, any number of things that make us up as a, you know, make us as an individual.
So what is a base pair in a gene? What actually is a base pair?
So the fundamental building block of DNA, which then, you know, it goes into the chromosomes, which then code for the amino acids, which go to make the proteins, which go to make our bones and muscles and tissues and neurons and everything else. So starting at these little base pairs, these single chemical units, you end up with the individual and of course, the interactions among these different base pairs as well. But so a simple change in one of these single chemical building blocks.
Like thymine, adenine, guanine.
Cysteine, guanine, exactly.
These are the chemicals that make up genes. There aren't many of them, are there? How many chemicals make up a gene?
We'll do a little basic biology here. There's four essential base pairs.
Only four essential basic
in DNA,
pairs in DNA, which produce all the different varieties of life forms on the planet.
Exactly.
Isn't that incredible?
It, of course, is the fundamental example of what we call homology across all living organisms, which is the strongest evidence, to my mind, for the common descent of all organisms on the planet, that we all share a common ancestor eventually.
It's so simple at the base level, so to speak, to produce these incredible varieties of life forms on the planet. Just incredible. Now, so describe what a phenotype is, Tim Musso.
Well, the phenotype is what we see. This is what we see in an individual. It's the shape, it's the size, it's the color, it's how quickly it develops, it's how many offspring it has, it's its behavior. It's what we observe at the individual level.
Yeah.
And so that of course is where natural selection occurs. At the individual level. So an individual that grows quicker maybe may start reproduction a little earlier and get a jump on its competition. An individual that grows a little larger and a little stronger may be able to deal with competition, that kind of thing. So we generally look at the level of phenotype when we're doing a life history studies.
I'm interviewing Professor Timothy Musso, Associate Vice President for Research and Graduate Education and Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. Now, Tim, have you, apart from seeing changes in colours of feathers and shape, body shape and tail feathers, have you been measuring the radioactive elements in the birds?
So we've done quite a large number of different kinds of studies. Because there's been so little done in the Chernobyl, and there's been so little basic biology done, we almost anything we do is new. So, yes, a number of years ago, we received a grant from the CRDF, the Civilian Research Development Foundation to look at just how radioactive these birds were in different parts of the zone. And we found that there was a lot of variability among individuals in how big a radioactive load they were carrying. Mm. And not surprisingly, the birds that were living in the areas that were most contaminated around them were the ones that were themselves the most contaminated. But what was really surprising to us from that particular study was that even within a highly radioactive area, we would find some individuals that were relatively radiation-free and other individuals that were very, very hot and very contaminated. So again, this spurred us on to look at some of the other behaviors and some of the other environmental influences that might affect how exposed individual organisms might be to this environment. So over the years, again, we've broadened our work from barn swallows, where we've looked at mutations at the level of DNA, we've looked at shape and size changes, we've looked at reproductive rates, and we broaden this to look at the entire community of birds, and including, I guess about 40 plus different species that are relatively common in this part of the world. And what we found is that there's tremendous variation among different species in their sensitivity to these contaminants. Some species appear, like the barn swallow, appear to be quite sensitive and showed remarkable drop-offs in numbers in the more contaminated areas, whereas some species, there's even a few species that actually increase in numbers, not more than a couple, but there are a couple that appear to increase in numbers in the contaminated areas, possibly because of lack of competition from birds that are no longer there. And then there are a number that show no effect of radiation. But overall, the large pattern, when you put it all together, is that most of these birds show some effect, strong negative effect, with, I think, fewer than half of the species actually being in these contaminated areas. About half of them have dropped out or have disappeared completely, really. And about, I think, less than half the numbers of birds overall as well.
Okay, so we're talking about you examining genetic mutations within the germ cells of the eggs and sperm that produce these phenotypical abnormalities or abnormalities in appearance. But what about evidence of malignancy in the birds?
Well, you know, again, cancers are a relatively rare occurrence, even in human populations, even in areas where it's at a very high frequency. And so it takes very, very large sample sizes to detect environmental consequences or environmental effects, even if there's a doubling or tripling of the rate. Yeah. But that said, we have been keeping track of all of the birds that we have collected over the years, and in the last decade, we have actually collected, well over 2,000 barn swallows from the Chernobyl region. And our colleagues and collaborators in other parts of the world have collected many, many thousands of barn swallows over the years. And what we've found are a number of occurrences of what appear to be tumors on the feet and the beaks and around the eyes of these birds. Now, again, the numbers are relatively low, and so it's any individual trait, like a tumor on the foot, doesn't occur often enough to really provide a large signal of the effect. But when you collect all of these kinds of abnormalities together, it's overwhelming. There are 13 or 14 abnormalities that occur in the barn swallows of the Chernobyl region, and I think 11 of them have never been reported from any other population, despite there having been many, many more of these birds collected and observed from these other areas.
Well, so what abnormalities are they that have never been seen before?
Oh, so these again, these tumors on the feet and these tumors around the beak.
Oh, the malignancies.
We don't know if they're malignant. We don't know the exact cause of these tumors.
But can't you examine them histologically and you surely can tell if they're malignant cells or not?
You could, and we have not had.
Oh, you have not done that.
We haven't had the funding to do
of
work to this point. Yeah, but we would love to do that.
Now, yeah. Tim, tell us: have you examined any other animals apart from birds?
You know, so a few years ago, when we first started to publish the work on barn swallows, there were critics in the audience. Imagine that, and who suggested that perhaps barn swallows were particularly sensitive, and so maybe we were looking at the wrong species. Just by chance alone, the barn swallows were showing this pattern.
Yeah.
And so we expanded our range to looking at the entire bird community. And as I mentioned earlier, we found dramatic effects on the overall bird community. But again, you know, the critics in the audience suggested, well, maybe birds as a group are just, you know, really sensitive. And if you expanded your observations to include other groups, maybe they wouldn't show these effects. And so we started.
Were these critics biologists?
We had all sorts of critics.
Like
some
what?
Of them were biologists.
Yeah.
There's always skeptics, and that being skeptical is good. And,
yeah.
We took it. It is, and so we took it in a constructive manner, and expanded our range of explorations as a consequence, and that was a good, very good thing. And we may not have done that without that constructive criticism. So we also started working on insects. My own personal research in the past is focused primarily on insects, especially grasshoppers and crickets. And so we decided that we would start working with these groups as well. They're easier to work with in some ways than birds, at least in terms of doing simple genetics and simple life history work. They're much harder to work with in terms of getting survival rates and some of these other characters that you can get with birds that are of more relevance perhaps to human populations, but they're still very useful tools. And so we started surveying the birds, the grasshoppers and the butterflies, the bees and spiders, much to our surprise, found a very strong signal of reduced abundance in the more contaminated areas. And
around Chernobyl.
In and around Chernobyl. One of the next criticisms we faced was from folks who suggested that maybe in Ukraine, in the Ukrainian side of the Chernobyl disaster, maybe there were other things going on. Maybe there were other heavy metals. Maybe it had nothing to do with radiation. And so we decided to expand our geographic range coverage to include Belarus.
Yeah.
And
which got a very high fallout, didn't it?
You know, Belarus, about a third of the country was relatively highly impacted. A lot of it was impacted with what I'm told was mainly cesium-137 contamination, not as much plutonium, not as much strontium, because of the way the weather patterns and the rainfall occurred.
Yes.
And the other thing about Belarus is that because it has a different system of government there, let's just put it that way, it's the last actually remaining European communist dictatorship, because of this difference in political system, the government there decided that cesium contamination was not that troublesome and thus allowed the farmers to return to these contaminated areas and to grow crops that they felt were not impacted by the cesium.
Oh, dear.
And so what we have in Belarus is a region that is highly contaminated, but it still has human habitation. Whereas in northern Ukraine, in the Chernobyl zone, highly contaminated, but there's a fence around it, keeping most of the people out. And so we've been able to compare the effects of contamination in relatively similar habitats with relatively similar levels of contamination, but in one area there's lots of human activity, in the other there's not. Because this, again, was another comment that people suggested, that we were observing the impacts of no human habitation and rather than radiation. And so we repeated these same sorts of surveys for birds and insects, both areas, and found the same effects, even when separated by about 200 kilometers in distance in a different country with a different set of social and environmental conditions. So birds, insects, spiders, again, all showed this drop-off in numbers and abundance, at least the particular species that we were surveying. Most recently, the comments have been, well, birds, insects, we don't care about them. We're really only interested in mammals, because as humans, as a mammal, we're particularly, that anything that happens to mammals is of particular relevance to us as a species. And so we've scratched our heads trying to figure out ways to actually look at mammal populations in these contaminated areas. Mammals are very difficult to work with. They're smart. They tend to avoid people as much as possible, even in these areas. They often are nocturnal. They often live underground most of the time. They tend to be very expensive and difficult to census in any sort of accurate way. And so we scratched our heads and came up with the notion of, well, let's just go out in the wintertime, mm-hmm. wait for a fresh snowfall, mm. and then we can run transects.
That's a good idea.
It's tried and true. This approach has been used by many biologists for many years. It's nothing that new. There are actually books that you can buy that show you the footprints of all the different species of mammals in this part of the world. And so we use these techniques, and we ran transects, and we found that, contrary to many of the sort of popular media reports, mammal abundances were also dramatically negatively impacted, with many fewer numbers and species in
really?
These most contaminated areas. Yeah.
And you looked at what? You looked at wolves, bears, wild boar?
There are no bears, contrary to popular notions. There, on the Ukrainian side of the Chernobyl zone, there are no bears.
Right.
We've never seen a bear. There hasn't been a bear in Ukraine in 100 years, apparently.
What did you look at,
yes,
then?
We found evidence of wolves and yeah. foxes, mice, rabbits, hares, and shrew, I guess, a number of smaller mammals. Dogs, cats, the whole spectrum.
And you found a decrease in their populations compared to non-radioactive areas. Is that right?
So that's right. So if you compare the areas that are, again, within this zone, this fenced-in zone, so they're all the same. All these different sites are similar in that they're. The humans have been excluded, but the habitat's very similar. And if you compare the areas that are uncontaminated or relatively clean to the areas that are contaminated with these radioisotopes, you find many fewer mammals in the contaminated areas. And that the distances between these hot and cold sites may not be that large, a few miles.
Yes, and yes.
So.
And that's the same all over Europe, actually. There are hot spots, in Scandinavia and in Cumbria and Wales in Britain and in Austria. So although you're dealing with very highly contaminated areas, there are moderately contaminated areas all over Europe. So let's go on, Professor Mousseau, from insects, birds and mammals to humans. And that's, of course, what you're doing your work for, to extrapolate from the genetic abnormalities you're finding to human abnormalities and human diseases. Can you talk about that and about the recent book that's been published by the New York Academy of Sciences on Chernobyl and all the papers that have been translated from Russian to English?
Absolutely. The Yeah, the new book has been very, very interesting. A few years ago, when we were doing our early studies, I started to look for literature in Russian because it seemed to me there must be a substantial literature that resulted from scientists working in the Chernobyl zone in Russia and Ukraine and Belarus immediately after the disaster.
Yeah,
and I found it was almost impossible to find most of this literature. A lot of it was, of course, it wasn't electronically available, and what existed was often in individuals' libraries, often not many copies available. And so we started a small project to compile the literature that we could find, and we didn't get very far. And then I met via the internet just a few years ago a gentleman by the name of Alexei Yablokov. Dr. Yablokov had been a fairly prominent environmental advisor in the former Soviet Union times, and had realized also that there was this large literature that was being ignored by Western scientists because it wasn't translated, because it was only available in Russian for the most part. And so he took it upon himself to compile this data set and this large compilation of the Eastern European literature, and organize it in a way, and translate it with the help of a number of folks along the way. And he sent me an early draft of one or two of the chapters, and I saw this and went, wow, this is exactly what I've been looking for. We need to get this published and make it accessible in the Western literature. And so we took this manuscript to the New York Academy of Sciences, and the editor at the time, Kirk Jensen, had a look at it and realized immediately what a treasure this was, absolutely unique compilation, and a profound relevance for anything relating to this topic. And commissioned the polishing of the book and the publication of the book. It was finally printed, I guess, late last year, and is now available from the New York Academy of Sciences. It has basically everything that you can imagine on the Chernobyl effects. It turns out there was an awful lot of work done, especially between 1986 and 1991-92. There was a dramatic drop-off in scientific activity after that, following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the serious economic crises that resulted from that. But the research that was conducted during that time frame, as well as some of the more recent material, is all in this book.
And doesn't it say, Professor Musso, that nearly a million people have died in Europe as a result of Chernobyl?
He suggests that if one extrapolates from what they know from the areas in Belarus and Russia and Ukraine, that one could easily arrive at that kind of number in terms of direct casualties resulting from the contamination. Unfortunately, because the records are very poor, the medical records, because it just makes epidemiological studies extremely difficult. There are no comprehensive registries of births and deaths in many of these regions. There are some very small localized areas where Western scientists have come in and attempted to compile data of this sort. So, for instance, there was a recent report in pediatrics by Vladimir Vrdulecki, who documented about a doubling of the rate of neural tube defects in parts of northern Ukraine that are downstream, not in the most contaminated areas, but still contaminated areas downstream of Chernobyl. Dr. Yablokov documents, again, dramatically elevated rates of all sorts of birth defects and other kinds of abnormalities in the human populations living in these areas. You know, if you look at the human survival rate data, which I guess is not terrible, what you find is that in Ukraine and Belarus, the adult life expectancy as of a few years ago was dramatically lower in Ukraine and Belarus as compared to, say, Hungary or Georgia, which suffered similar kinds of economic and social consequences from the collapse of the Soviet Union, but didn't suffer from the radioactive contaminants. So again, it's very difficult to ascribe the, you know, an individual mortality to a given cause like radioactive contamination when there's so many other things going on in these populations. But overall, if you take everything and put it together, I think the evidence is quite overwhelming.
Yes. Okay, so I have two very pertinent questions for you, Tim, and I'm interviewing Professor Timothy Musso, Associate Vice President for Research in Graduate Education and Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. Two very specific questions, and I want you to try and be honest. One is, who predominantly are the people who are overtly critiquing your data? And when you find one set of data, they say, yeah, but what about this? And then you do another set and they say, yeah, but what about this? That's number one. Number two, why has not the world community of WHO, World Health Organization, and the United Nations taken on the responsibility of doing the research of the human populations exposed to this most extraordinary event, the Chernobyl meltdown? And why has there been this conspiracy of silence by the International Atomic Energy Agency, who say only 56 people have died? This is one of the more extraordinary conspiracies I have ever read about in my life. So there are three questions for you.
Yes.
And I want you to be really frank. I know it's difficult being a scientist, Tim, but please, because this is all part of science.
It is very difficult because I don't really have all the answers, obviously.
No.
It is a complete mystery to me as to why there hasn't been substantially larger, and it wouldn't take much, investment in research in this part of the world. It is so obvious that this provides, that there's an opportunity to conduct the sorts of studies that you can't conduct anywhere else on the planet.
Mm.
And it wouldn't take a whole lot of resources to make a lot of headway. We've published on the order of 30 papers on Chernobyl effects in the last 10 years, and you know, it's cost us, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars perhaps in our time. You know, it's not particularly expensive work to do. But it does require some level of investment and some level of interest on the part of the granting agency.
Yep.
We've submitted proposals to a number of agencies, and some of them have been funded, but most have not. And part of the reasons given have been that we in the U.S. at least, there's a tendency to invest in research that's conducted in the U.S. And then, you know, that makes some sense. But in terms of, and there's been this suggestion that what happened in Chernobyl is not relevant to the larger nuclear energy issue.
Oh, my God, how ridiculous.
This has been suggested
that
many times.
That is ridiculous. And, you know, I just want to hark back to the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission when it was, this was an American organization, which examined the survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For years, they're still examining them. They're their guinea pigs. And from that data, we've derived the information about how much exposure we can give to our patients in medicine and the like. So this is so relevant now with the meltdown at Chernobyl and the meltdown at Three Mile Island too, that it simply has not been looked at, and the money was available for Hiroshima and Nagasaki and has not been available for this huge, massive experiment done on millions and millions of people.
Well, I think the primary reason that there hasn't been the investment is because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course. The main reason for all of the research on atomic bomb survivors is because the U.S. was, took some responsibility and invested heavily in that research, whereas, the U.S. and other Western countries feel relatively little or no responsibility for what happened in Chernobyl, and probably rightly so.
But scientifically, it's such an interesting proposition to examine this.
I think it's a unique opportunity that has profound relevance, and it boggles my mind to see the resistance to pursuing this as a research opportunity. Now, it's not an easy place to work. There are many challenges to working there, and so there are not a lot of people who've been pushing to go there and conduct research. But I think if there was some higher level interest, I think there could be a lot done. So right now, for instance, there's a group of us working with Ukrainian National Academy of Science members to organize a laboratory for what we're calling microevolutionary studies of the Chernobyl effects, and loose translation from Ukrainian. And of course, the problem is that Ukraine's economy is in very, very serious shape.
Yeah.
And so there's very little funding to even support, the people who need such tremendous amounts of help there, let alone medical help, yes. Let alone invest in a laboratory to conduct basic science. So I don't fault them for that.
No, but where does the skepticism come towards your research, Tim?
Well,
I'm asking you really, is it the nuclear industry that are obfuscating and being difficult?
I couldn't say. Certainly there has not been any interest in conducting this kind of research by the nuclear industry. But again, it's not surprising. Why would they?
Well, what about the International Atomic Energy Agency propagating this lie that only 56 people died at Chernobyl? Can you explain that?
Yeah, it if you read, I'm not sure, did you get a chance to read the Chernobyl Forum reports that came out a few years ago?
No.
They were quite interesting. They were reports that were funded by and promoted by the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a gathering of leading scientists from around the world, including Eastern European scientists, who had experience in radiobiology and the health consequences of radioactive contaminants. And they released a series of reports that on health and environment, where they basically ignored all of the Eastern European literature to begin with, and focused exclusively on the literature from Westerners, and were published in the Western literature, and because there's been so little research done, there have been very little reports, and this was interpreted as evidence that there was no effect of Chernobyl. And of course, again, that's completely... many of the Eastern European participants were actually outraged by this position and voiced and actually generated sort of a minority report in opposition, but it wasn't heard anywhere. Myself and a very prominent Ukrainian National Academy member who was a member of the Chernobyl Forum, and a fellow from our the US EPA, who's a specialist in the effects of radon, published a response in Nature, a letter to Nature, where we objected to the tone of these reports, but we were largely ignored. There were a couple of scientists from Great Britain who actually went through the data again.
Yeah, Chris Busby and the others.
Yeah, but Chris Busby has done some amazing work. He just recently published a paper on leukemia, actually, that's worth looking at, again, showing that that there are there's a spike in leukemia in children who were born who were exposed in utero to the Chernobyl effects across Europe. So there's a growing literature developing as we develop the tools to mine some of the registries that exist in Western Europe where there was exposure, in Scandinavia in particular. And but it's really just a drop in the bucket compared to what information we could be getting.
Yes.
if we were looking at the human populations and the plant and animal populations in Ukraine and Belarus and in Russia, we could be greatly advancing this field at a great rate.
Well, do you know if what sort of response has there been then from the scientific community to the new Chernobyl book that's been published by the New York Academy of Sciences?
I haven't heard a whole lot of responses other than this is, amazing and very surprising, and this really suggests to us that there's a lot more that needs to be done. But again, there's this tendency in the Western countries to not be as interested in the events of Eastern Europe because it's perceived that it's of little limited relevance to their own situation.
Yes, I wonder what's going to happen when the next meltdown occurs in the United States, Tim Musso.
Well, let's hope that never occurs. But there's no such thing there's always opportunity for disaster.
Of course, especially with complex systems.
Indeed.
Yes. Well, look, I think we've reached the end of our time, Tim. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion, one that I've wanted to have with you for a long time. I hope people have learnt a lot from this and are stimulated to find out more about the whole situation. Now, do you have a web page, Tim?
We certainly do. If you go to... if you type in, Chernobyl barn swallow into Google, you'll bring up our main webpage. But our main webpage is simply cricket, C-R-I-C-K-E-T, .biol.sc.edu, and that'll bring up the homepage.
All right. Well, just repeat that one again.
Sure. Cricket, as in the game, .biol. Biol, B-I-O-L, .sc.edu. No www, just cricket.biol.sc.edu. And that'll bring up our homepage, including a little banner at the bottom that has the Chernobyl Research Initiative.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Timothy Musso, for a fascinating discussion. And as you proceed with your work, I think it would be good to do a follow-up interview probably in about a year's time.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Helen. Yeah. Nice talking to you.
On If You Love This Planet Today, I've been speaking with Professor Timothy Musso, Associate Vice President for Research and Graduate Education and Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. We will now be excerpting a segment of a speech I gave in Vermont at St. Michael's College in Burlington in 2010.
Tonight, the title of Dr. Caldicott's talk is In Our Backyard, The Health Risks of Nuclear Power. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Caldicott to St. Michael's College.
Good evening. I'm going to walk you through the medical implications of the nuclear fuel cycle tonight, beginning with uranium mining, because I'm very familiar with that, because 40% of the world's richest uranium happens to reside in my country, Australia. The Chinese are moving in, other multinationals are moving in, and our country's full of natural resources like mountains of iron ore and gold nuggets and you name it, because we're the most ancient continent on Earth, and we've been so eroded that all the minerals present themselves. We're a third world country. We export raw materials and we import finished goods. But we don't have nuclear power in Australia because it's too dangerous for us. We just export it to the rest of the world. So I'm going to walk you through radiation biology and the whole fuel cycle. First of all, by saying that this book, which is for sale outside, called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, deals with the fact nuclear power causes global warming, that it's so expensive it's a totally socialist industry like the Pentagon. So in fact, you're a very socialist country because most of your taxes go to the Pentagon, which spends about $1 trillion a year on weapons. That's socialisation of killing. All the reactors were built with your money and the insurance is paid for by your money. And you've got Medicare and Medicaid and all the rest. So it's very funny that people are getting very upset saying that Obama and others are heading towards socialism. Okay, uranium has two isotopes, 235 and 238. This is the fissionable one. It's only present in 0.7% in the ore. It must be enriched to 3% for use in nuclear power, or greater than 50%, and you've got bomb-grade materials. So any country that has a uranium enrichment plant can make bomb-grade material. That's why everyone's upset about Iran. Israel has the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, which she neither confirms nor denies. And of the 26,000 hydrogen bombs in the world that stand ready to go, some of them, America and Russia own 97% of them. So in fact, the real rogue states are Russia and America, the axis of evil holding the world at nuclear ransom, and we could have a nuclear war tonight by accident, by cyber hacking or by design. Under the Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it says that countries aren't allowed to make bombs. Only the ones that have got the bombs can keep them because they're stable and the best countries, but other countries are not allowed to have them. But it's very important that all countries have access to nuclear power and nuclear technology. And part of the nuclear technology is uranium enrichment, because you're enriching it for nuclear power. So what Iran is doing is totally legal under international law. You have been listening to an excerpt from a speech I gave at St. Michael's College in Burlington, Vermont, in March 2010. If you want to find out more about the program, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you'd like to contribute, there's a place that you can contribute there. I look forward to speaking with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.